morning.
I've had quite a few calls about what I'm going to talk about today. So apparently I have a proclivity to upset people. A couple of things that in terms of some of the conversation that we saw earlier today, and we talked about how cattle are getting fatter. One of the things that I think you can directly attribute to the beef quality audit is, because I can tell you that almost to the day when cattle started getting fatter. And what that amounts to is that when they did the audit, they looked at their percent fours and fives and looked back at what the industry was reporting in terms of fours and fives, and there was a disparity. USDA went out and told their graders they got to make more, find more fours and fives. That's how, basically, if you want to look at that uptick, a big chunk of that is just exactly that. It came from the beef quality audit. So, you know, if you're saying, well, cattle are getting fatter, we have put more days on, but also I think the USDA and the beef quality audit have also increased, have caused graders to adjust. Also with instrument grading now, I think we're probably more accurately reflecting what the industry is today. 5-6 years ago, we went from where fours were 1 or 2% in our plant in Texas to today where we're 10 or 12. It's more reflective. I think cattle, if I look at our data, what we would tell you is that if you look at same days on feed, same kind of cattle, we didn't have nearly the number of fours 4 or 5 years ago. So just that one comment before I start on some other things. Let's see. Random thoughts about DNA markers. Kind of to get a little bit idea where I've been in this and what I've done. About 4 or 5, well, probably longer than that, Jerry. 10 years ago? 8. I was with Continental Grains Cattle Feeding Division. We were looking at ways to narrow the variation in our inventories, and we had spent a lot of time trying to think through different ways. Read an article about Texas A&M doing a genome scan on cattle and thought, gee, this stuff might work. So went down there, spent some time with Jerry, Scott Davis, Sarah Davis, who's here, I think, and looked at DNA and said, you know, this might make some sense. So we put some money together and got started on it. Bluntly, it was a task for our company that was probably too great, so we bowed out. But I've been watching the technology and looking at it for a while, so I've got a little experience with it. From the cattle feeding side, Five Rivers Ranch is right now the largest cattle feeding company in the United States. We have 10 feed yards. We keep about 750,000 head of cattle on feed at any given point in time. We market cattle to 4 different packers, sell or provide cattle on 5 different branded beef programs. Everything from a never had it, never will natural program to a guaranteed tender program. So we run a whole wide range of programs. We look at a lot of different things, and some of the slides I'll talk about are, we're very focused as a feeding company on embracing this variation that we've talked about and trying to manage the endpoints. Random thoughts about the DNA markers. There's 5 or 6 companies now doing DNA analysis. Probably the most obvious one and probably the most beneficial one to date has been Parentage. Dr. Daly has done a lot of work out in California looking at Parentage and really finding out which bull sired which calf and trying to, in a commercial sense, I think has really done a lot of good. Then we started seeing more specific tests, black coat color, myostatin, leptin, TH, pH. But I think the common theme is it's one gene. All these products were one gene. Then we started going into markers and more things had to be measured. Marbling, tenderness, growth, horn pull, feed to gain. These are all things that we're talking about now and looking at markers to use. I think they're very challenging types of information, because the reality is that we know more than one gene has impact across all of these, plus you have tremendous environmental issues to deal with also as well. So the question comes down, are DNA markers better than EPDs? Right now the answer is easy, no. The number one reason that producers today understand what a birth weight of plus one is because we spend a tremendous amount of time and a lot of time talking about exactly what it is. the real issue, and I can take a shot at this because when we formed Genomic Effects, we also worked with Genetic Solutions, Dr. Hetzel and Dr. Davis. What is one star? What does two stars mean? At that point in time, because you only had a handful of genes, it really just, you know, you could understand it. But the more genes you get, what does five stars mean? What does 10 stars mean? What does a genetic indicator mean? I mean, you got to be really careful with this technology because producers don't have the time nor the inclination to learn a whole new language in terms of what genetics mean in terms of a population of cattle. I mean, for goodness sakes, you know, think about how much time you had to spend just on birth weight. Make them understand what birth weight is. Make them understand what IMF is. And I really believe today that some of these numbers people are using, but they don't really even understand what they are, and they're the rudimentary numbers. So when you stack, you know, these DNA markers on top of it, my guess is that they're going to be a lot more confused than they are going to have any kind of answer or ability to use it. So if they're confused and they apply it, you're going to have disastrous results. So next part is I'm going to talk a little about, and it's the main reason why I actually went to Texas A&M to look at this stuff, was feedlot DNA testing. Because today, we don't have any cattle that we buy that have a feedlot EPD or anything that we have some understanding, we have some past history, but the reality is that we don't have the opportunity to buy feeder cattle based on some kind of EPD. So the thought was, well, maybe we can look at DNA information because it's better than nothing. If we had EPDs, it'd be better still, but we don't. Right now, the only accuracy that we have is that we live on an average. And that's really what it comes down to, is because the slides that you've seen today, the variation within populations is huge. I mean, that's really what the key is that, you know, you can make broad sweeping statements, but within each observation, there's huge variation. And so the only way I know that we can increase accuracy is buy more. Bankers really believe that too. Next, what I'd like to do here is to kind of give you guys a sense, and I'd like to get a sense back of where you see in terms of value from a feedlot perspective, is to ask these questions. And then it'll come back and we'll tie it back to DNA. Okay. First one is, in terms of using the following scale, please rate each trait, 1 being very valuable, 5 not being very valuable. Weight. In terms of what a feedlot, if a feedlot producer is looking at cattle, how valuable is that information? Okay, let's go to the next one and then we'll summarize them at the end. Number 2 is condition. Number 3, breed. Number 4, location. Oh, I'm sorry, source age, verified. Number 5, location. Number 6, vaccination records. Number 7, knowledge about whose bulls they bought in the last 2 years. Okay. Wait. Let's talk about wait for a second. Weight is the key to the feedlot business. Pounds. Make no mistake about it, pounds drive profitability in the feedlot business. Anybody who doesn't believe that has never fed a pen of cattle. Pounds drive this industry. Number two, condition. We always buy condition before we buy anything else. We realize we're giving up quality grade, but the reality is that if I can put 50 pounds of gain on cheap, I'll take that every day over quality grade. Every day. Because I know I can put, it's something I can bank on. I can't bank on quality grade. Number three, breed. It's a tough one. The reality is that we try to buy, because we have programs that require black-headed cattle, we end up buying cattle that we think are Angus. The reality is when we actually start sorting them in a couple of the programs, phenotypically we have to make them look like an Angus. So out of 100 head of cattle that we buy that we think are, that are black, probably 50, 60 head actually make it into the sort of the pen because they're either too much sheath, too exotic looking, too heavy muscled, you know, something that's something different about them that excludes them. But black-headed cattle do bring a premium, bottom line, every day. Source age verified. The reality is, guys, is that there's a handful of people willing to pay something for it. We don't. We've chosen not to participate in that market, and I'll tell you why. There's three reasons why we don't. I think there's an opportunity, but from the age-verified standpoint today, the premiums are hard to earn. You have a lot of work to go to get through to get qualified. And the third thing is that with given the IOE status and BSC and everything in Japan, my expectation is within a year we're probably looking at 30 months rather than 20 months. So the opportunities there are really narrow and very specific. The other part is that, let's face it, if you look at the calf crop, 65-70% of those calves that are certifiable come April, May, June, July. Now, if all of them come in one period, what do you think a packer's going to do? He's not going to give you nearly as much because there's just too many of them. Now, if you have cattle that are, you can age verify that come in December, January or February, there's a tremendous opportunity because there's just not as many of them. So there is a window and there's a significant opportunity there. Okay, next one. Location. Location is a fundamental principle of ours from the standpoint that if cattle are close, we know we're probably going to have fewer health issues with them. And it's also with the cost of gasoline today, you know, it makes a huge difference in terms of where you put these cattle and also in the health issue. Vaccination, absolutely. Healthy cattle, one thing we do know is healthy cattle translate into more profitable cattle, cattle that grade better, yield better, feed better, just they're better cattle. Now, this is an interesting one because we see Superior do this all the time, you know, putting, you know, blank and blank's names on the bulls. And I don't want to irritate anybody in here, but the reality is, in terms of our guys, I mean, when we buy cattle, it may make a little difference, but what we realize is we're going to have to pay more for those cattle. How much more? I don't know. But the thing that I will tell you is that if I compare that population of cattle across and look at that group, the premium that I pay for those cattle is generally offset by, you know, the overall P&L of those cattle is almost exactly the same as the cattle that I buy in my commodity mix. So what I'm saying is I pay more for them, I get a little more performance out of them, but I sure don't earn, they don't make me any more money as a buyer. So the real question is what does all that mean? Well, I think the point that I want to make is that one of the things I didn't put up there is, you know, ability to marble and using, you know, the reality is that we buy about 1.2 million head of cattle a year. In the north, our cattle will grade somewhere between 50 and 55% choice across the year. Maybe we'll have some spikes, ups and downs. In the south, cattle grade 30 to 40, depending upon the time of the year. But I think what we're really more interested in is using this technology not to procure across the entire population, but to segment populations of cattle. And that's really what I want to talk about, is that we're focused on managing variation. Right now, the three things that we've used are weight and breed, and we've also used ultrasound to some extent for specific programs that we have to ensure a minimum threshold on grade. We aren't using it today, but we do sort cattle by weight, and we do sort cattle by breed to fit programs. If we had DNA information, it makes for ability to segregate cattle into more prescriptive kinds of feeding programs. Now, one way I can make cattle choice, and forgive me, Pete, but is not put an implant in cattle. It's easy, because our natural cattle do grade significantly better than our cattle that don't have an implant. But the question you got to ask yourself is if the choice select spread is $6 like it is today, which would be on an 800-pound carcass, $48, am I willing to give up that 75 pounds of weight and feed efficiency on the implant? And our answer is no. How much DNA information do you need? I've been asked that a lot. And the reality is I don't know. I don't think anybody else knows yet either. I do know that two or three markers for anything that is complex as marbling or tenderness or growth probably isn't going to get you there. The other thing I know is that if you use markers to sort cattle for broad specifics, are you going to end up with cattle that are Angus or English in one pen, Continentals in another pen, and Bos Indicus in another pen? Because what I'm really looking for, because I feed a lot of Bos Indicus cattle in the south, bluntly, is that what I'm really looking for is a test that can sort that within that breed type. Can you rank or stratify or put them into a quartile? Angus, you know, the best Angus, the worst Angus, best Brahmin to the worst Brahmin, so I can start. Because the reality is within each one of these groups, there's cattle I can use in different programs and have different opportunities to utilize. What are you going to do with it? From a feedlot perspective, we've got to keep it incredibly simple and very basic. Labor in a feedlot today is a choke point. With the places that we're at, we're always understaffed, always. The ability to execute, and I've learned this the hard way, as trying to put two or three programs into one feedlot, and the feedlot manager finally one day called me and said, you know, you need to come down here and do this for a while. And started to understand the complexity to manage more than two programs in a feed yard is just, it's you really can't do a very good job. And the reason is because think about these feed yards in terms of the processes and the things that you're asking people to do. This technology is darn tech. I mean, you know, we're sitting in here trying to get our minds around it, and you've got PhDs, masters, and, you know, you've got the industry-leading people here. When I sit down with somebody at the feed yard, and he's really more interested about going home to his kid's baseball game than he is really understanding what DNA is or anything else, we've got to get this stuff down to a level where people can understand it and can execute it on a basic way. And that's really what you've got to do. You've got to identify one or two things and build programs around those one or two things. When you try to be all-encompassing in a program, the only thing you're going to do is make it very expensive, very prohibitive, and you're not going to sell very much. Value added in the feedlot. And that's something that's really pretty darn new, I think. When I started in the feedlot business, basically it was a run-and-jam business. You know, we sat there for a long time and refused to sell cattle on a grid because we sold on the average and we sold cattle in the cash market and wanted to support that, and we didn't do anything commodity-wise. We thought natural cattle were crazy. You know, all this stuff is just silly. Well, along about 2001, 2002, I guess what they say is when you feel the heat, you learn something. Well, we started to learn that we needed to grow the top line, because just cutting costs constantly isn't, you know, it's a way to sustain yourself, but you can't make a thriving long-term business. So in the feedlots today, there's new products now for over $15 a head. The thing that you need to understand is that over the last 25 years, cattle feeding is just basically a net sum game. That's why, by definition, it's a commodity business. Guy that manages his risk a little bit better, is just slightly better than the average, probably has some long-term viability in the business. But the real issue is that you have to be a little bit better. And just understand, when you ask someone in a feedlot business to spend $15, $20 a head on something, that's taking a huge leap of faith, because that's basically 20 years worth of profits. So just understand that when you're looking at some of these new technologies and why people might push back. When you look at an implant, the payback on that is significant. When you look at, from our perspective, when we're offered opportunities, we at least have to have a 3-to-1 payback before we'll even entertain it. Well, that's kind of the end of my ramblings on DNA. They indulged me on a couple of things here. One of the things that I wanted to talk to this group about is this new CME contract and some of the revisions that we're doing. CME is proposing that we increase average carcass or live weights up to 1,425, with a maximum weight increased from 1,400 to 1,475. What this will do is it's going to bring the live delivery process in line with the slaughter process. The industry today doesn't discount carcasses typically under 1,000, over 950, and in most cases over 1,000. And a lot of you guys are standing around here saying, well, why are you guys talking to me about this? Well, what it amounts to is that the last time we did this, several of the breed associations sent letters in protesting the increase in carcass weights and were lamenting the fact that we were doing this. And I just wanted to give you guys kind of the position that from the other side, and that is that, it's an issue. We've grown these, the only way we can make pay $1.20, $1.25 for a calf is to make these cattle big. That's really what it comes down to is that if you think about this business in terms of pounds, it's a fixed cost business. And the only way you're able to let everybody survive in it is you've got to have enough pounds to cover costs. And with that, I thank you for your indulgence, and I don't know, Mark, who's...